Hello, everybody, and welcome to this inaugural edition of From Cincinnati, a podcast about people from Cincinnati who are doing great things out in the world, whether they stayed here or they moved elsewhere. So excited to bring you today's guest, who is Jay Moriarty, who you may have figured out from the Facebook post. Jay was the executive producer on the first several seasons of The Jeffersons and was a writer on All of the Family, and worked for Norman Lear for a number of years. If you know who Norman Lear is, he is the television pioneer. He's still alive. He's 97 years old, and they've been recreating some of his shows on ABC on the show called In Front of a Live Audience, which is co-hosted by Mr. Lear and Jimmy Kimmel. Well, Jay happens to be from Cincinnati. So very excited. Had a conversation with him now going back a couple months, and we talk about all sorts of things, including his time working for Bill Cosby on The Cosby Show, and lots of other things as well, too. So I'm looking forward to having everybody take a listen to this podcast, and I'd love to hear your feedback. I'd also like to thank Chris Collier for allowing us to use her music on today's podcast. Check her out online. We had a link on our website at FromCincinnati.com. With no further ado is my conversation with Jay Moriarty, out in Los Angeles. We were actually in Hollywood recording this. So you've been doing this a long time. So you
I mean, people know
you be, yes. How can I ask you, how old are you?
I'm pretty darn old.
Pretty darn old. Okay.
Yeah, I can tell you this. I do I'm on Medicare.
Okay.
Which I'm happy to
yeah.
You sweat out those last years before you hit that big 65, and you know, and you say, I've never had an experience before where I wanted to get older, you know.
Right.
Once you turn 60, you say, when am I going to be 65 so I can get Medicare, get free health care?
Right.
Although the Writers Guild has a pretty good health
plan. I wanted to get 25, turn 25 so I could rent a car.
Oh, yeah.
That was a big deal.
Me, I want to turn 21. It was always 20 because my parents would always say, you know, as long as you're living in under this roof.
You try not to hit the table.
I'm sorry.
I know. I'm sorry. Because I think that will be picked up by the microphones. We don't have the boom, unfortunately. Sorry.
Yeah. No, but you know, 21 was a big thing because supposedly you could drink and all that, which in Cincinnati you could drink Utipol and
right.
Burger beer, but you actually could drink when you were 18 there, 3-2 beer. Do they still have 3-2 beer?
No, that's long gone. Heard about 3-2 beer. I think that came about, that ended, I should say, right before I was able to drink. So
that was big in college, you know, because you could go to all the college bars if you were 18 and they only had 3-2 beer.
Right. So what you went to St. X High School.
That's true.
And you lived in Finneytown.
That's right.
And you came out. So you went, what'd you study? You went to University as well.
Yeah, right? I went to Xavier University.
What'd you study at Xavier?
English. Majored in English. You know, in those days they had no screenwriting programs, nothing to do with writing for television.
Did you know you wanted to do screenwriting?
Well, yeah. You know what? I think when I was a kid, I remember I was always kind of into comedy, you know. Try to be funny in class and that kind of stuff, you know, and I like getting up and give speeches. And actually, teachers, a lot of times when I write stuff in class, the teacher would read it out loud, you know. And,
oh, really?
Which kind of embarrassed me at first until everybody started laughing.
And okay.
You feel a real power if you can actually make somebody laugh, you know. And,
oh, yeah.
But it was just a thing. There was a time in there I wanted to be a priest, too, but even when I wanted to be a priest, I wanted to be a writing priest, you know, so I always figured writing was... But I remember watching TV when I was young and you know, watching Lucy and Ethel, you know, and thinking that these people were just funny. I didn't realize. And then I remember seeing a crawl at one point that said writers. And I thought, right? You mean there's people that write this stuff? You know, hey, that'd be a decent job. You know, you can write stuff for people that's funny. And then you get to hang out with Lucy and
I'm envious
Ricky
of anybody who knew. Yeah, you get to write. You knew what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed to me like that was a fun. I couldn't, as I got older, I couldn't think of anything more fun to do than like you actually could get paid for that. But you couldn't tell anybody in Ohio that's what you wanted. Yeah, I want to write comedy. They just look at you like you're nuts, you know.
Yeah.
You want to write for television. Nobody, I didn't know any, you know, you don't know anybody in Cincinnati who writes for television. It's not like
I don't.
A real job, you know.
And so, maybe the right script for the newscast or something like that.
People just look at me like, good luck with that. So
right. So you grew up in Finneytown. What did your parents do?
My dad was a stockbroker. He worked for W.E. Hutton, which I think is I don't know if it's still there downtown Cincinnati.
I don't know. I've heard the name. I don't know. I don't think so. But
4th and Walnut.
Yeah.
And he was a stockbroker, and my mom was a homemaker. You know, he had four kids.
Okay. And was that a pretty good upbringing, was it?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was nice. We were the, you know, the white middle class family, you know.
So stockbroker make pretty good money then?
It made okay. We could move from, you know, one house to another. I grew up in, well, first I had a, I think until I was 3 years old, I was the first one. We lived in an apartment in Evans. Was it Evanston? Evanston? Something like that.
And Evanston, right near Xavier then. Xavier University.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yep. And in fact, the way they got that apartment, I remember my mom saying my grandfather was a fireman. And in those days, like after the war, okay. when my
like
dad...
Like for the city or something? Or
yeah, for Norwood.
Oh, for the city of Norwood.
Norwood.
Okay.
After World War II, there was hard apartments were like real scarce, and because this landlord happened to be there, was like 100 people trying to get the same apartment. And they knew my grandfather Moriarty was a fireman for Norwood in Norwood.
Okay.
And so you're Moriarty, well, yeah, okay.
Oh.
But then in Gulf Manor, if you know where Gulf Manor is,
sure did.
I lived there
sure
till I was 10, and then we moved to Finneytown.
Okay,
and it was like that. Finneytown, when it was time for me to go to high school, that's where the new St. Xavier was in Finneytown.
Yeah.
So it was the closest one to me. And a number of my buddies from St. Vivian's grade school, we end up going to.
St. Vivian's in...
St. X. That's in Finneytown.
Yeah, St. Oh, right. Of course. That's my grandmother's
right
parish.
Wynn okay, Road. I just live right down from the church. I was like a block away. So I would get all the early masses as an older boy. I had to be at the early 5:30 mass.
So you're a Catholic boy from
Cincinnati.
Yeah,
I was raised Catholic.
Raised Catholic, yeah. Raised, a lot of raised Catholics.
I was raised Catholic, and then I was went to Jesuit high school and Jesuit college. So I was raised Jesuit then. And
Jesuits good a little education more of those Jesuits, right?
They let you eat cereal before communion. I remember my mom said, "Well, how come you're eating cereal? You're not going to communion."
Oh, yeah.
No, no. You know, Father Schroeder said we can eat cereal before. I
got yelled at that. My grandmother. It's funny you say that because I've never heard anybody say that except for my grandmother yelled at me one time about, "Well, you know, you can't take communion now."
Yeah.
And I'm like, why? She goes, because you can't mix Jesus with toast or some whatever it was, you know, a cheeseburger from McDonald's or whatever it was I was eating.
So that
was definitely a thing. So then you you go there, and so about how old were you when you were like this writer thing you're seeing?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've just as I mentioned before, I'm just writing a book about that now, and I'm reflecting on all that I'm actually writing it. It's a combination of like a novel and a memoir because I'm turning. I called the character, the book initially, what I was writing is titled Midwest Murphy Goes to Hollywood. And Murphy is just a name I use for, I write everything I did, it's about me.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I get tired of saying I and we and my and me
so
and
you
I.
You made up a guy named Murphy?
Yeah, a guy named Murphy. So I talk about Murphy and he leaves Ohio. In fact, chapter one's called Leaving Ohio.
Okay.
But I knew, and Murph knows, when he wants to write comedy for television.
Okay.
And when I came out here.
That's amazing. And
I got married. The amazing thing was, I guess when you look back on it, and I remember my uncle at the wedding saying, you know, you got more balls than I do. You get married without a job, you know?
Yeah.
So I was got married and, you know, it was my high school sweetheart and talked her into, let's go to California.
You got married in Cincinnati then?
Got married in Cincinnati.
Where you guys hadn't lived in LA?
Bellarmine Chapel at XU.
Oh my gosh. Stadium. Yeah. Yeah. The iconic Bellarmine
Chapel. And, you know, all my friends from high school and stuff, you know, guys I hung around with were two of them served the wedding, in fact.
So what did your bride, did she have a job?
No. Well, she worked as a florist. So she actually, she was like a year younger than me, but she'd taken a couple of night classes in college, but it basically worked as a florist. So when we got here, she was the first one in LA to get a job because she got a job at a flower shop in Burbank.
And that was what you're doing. You're moving to LA to get a writing job.
Yeah. Well, I knew I wanted to write for TV, but I knew nothing about, you know, I knew nothing about scripts or anything. We had nothing
you don't learn that in
LA. I knew I was an English major, so I knew how to spell and I knew grammar. So I figured, but I wasn't naive enough to think I could, you know, walk onto a set and say, I'm going to write for the show. So I had to learn. I know I had to learn what I
can you say about what year that was?
Then? Yeah, that was 1968 when I graduated college. 68, if you recall, was a kind of an upheaval year politically. Martin Luther King was shot.
Yeah.
Bobby Kennedy was shot.
Yeah.
I remember at our graduation ceremony in June, Bobby Kennedy was lying in the hospital. They weren't sure if he was going to live or die.
Wow.
He'd been shot the night. I woke up that morning in my cap and gown on my chair ready to go and found out that Bobby Kennedy had been shot. And so he had to go off to, you know, the... speaker there at the commencement is saying, you know, you guys are starting your world off, but here's Bobby Kennedy shot, Martin Luther King was dead. It was a kind of crazy year.
Yeah.
So when I came out, I was actually, what I thought, you know, comedy to me, I thought of as a weapon and try to, I wanted to write relevant comedy. The only relevant comedy really on TV at that time was the Smothers Brothers Show and Laugh-In, if you remember those shows.
Yeah,
They were the big shows back then. And the sitcoms were like Petticoat Junction and Beverly Hillbillies and you know, that kind of stuff. And so when I came to L.A., I knew, like I said, my wife had a job before I did. I remember I was there for about a month and still didn't have a job. And my father-in-law, usually was pretty, didn't have much to say to me, was suddenly on the phone, and the message was like, "Oh, when are you going to start working?" You
know? Oh, so, really? Yeah.
So, because I would go looking for a job during the day and go body surfing in the afternoon, and that was a good time. But anyway,
sure. And what a time to be out in California in the late 60s,
Well, it was great. It was the mid-60s in July when we got there. We got married in July and took a couple weeks on honeymoon going through Yellowstone. I had spent a summer at Yellowstone Park when I was 19 working there.
Oh, cool.
So kind of went through there and did the honeymoon thing, went down through San Francisco, got in L.A. And it seemed like a while, but when I look back at it, like I'm writing this book, I was actually September 1st is when I actually got first job. What I did, I went around to a number of places, and I looked at a chart that I remember. It said a college graduate should make $600 a month.
Okay.
Which was fine then. You could live on that. So
I had
a newspaper in Burbank offered me a job for $550. And as a Cub reporter, or whatever, on Burbank. But I said, that's not enough. You know, I got to make $600. And I went to an agency, you know, where you job employment agency, and guy there offered me a job there. So, well, you can come and you can interview people like I'm doing, and you work here until your job comes. So I said, well, I don't want to get a job helping other people get jobs. But I saw an ad in the LA Times. It said communications writer. So I wasn't sure what that meant, but I minored in communications, and I wanted to be a writer. So I went down and interviewed for that, and I was at what was then called Pacific Mutual Life Insurance Company. They call it Pacific Life now. And they had me take a test, and the gal said, "Oh, you scored way high on the test." So he took me up to meet Tom Santley, the guy that became my boss, and we talked. You know, I had my suit and tie on, the one suit and tie that I had at that time, and he put me in a conference room, gave me a yellow pad and a pen, and said, "Write something about the freeways." So I wrote this thing about the freeways, which I include in the book I just wrote. I happen to have the same thing I wrote there. And so whatever, you know, it's somebody wants to say, this is what got me a job. I'm not sure why, but so I wrote something, and so I got hired. And actually, it was a great gig. I lasted there almost, it was about 4 years working there, writing promotion, writing everything from advertising copy to speeches for executives and stuff like that.
So still with an eye on the prize.
And I was... tell you, like a first one of the agencies, there was a Rappaport, you know, a life insurance company has agencies all over the country, and the Chicago agency was called the Rappaport agency, and the owner's son John Rappaport wrote for was writing for all in the for the Laugh-In. So I thought that was great. You know, there's a guy writing for Laugh-In, and I called, went over to see him. I was 20 actually, if I'm telling this in order. The first writer I met, which was a big deal to me, to write somebody who actually meet somebody who actually makes a living writing for TV. There was a Cincinnati, one of my best friends from Cincinnati, Rob Kennedy. His parents lived out here, and his younger brother lived out here. And I went to see them when I came out, you know, to visit him. And his younger brother, it was in high school, and there was a guy, Jack Hanrahan, who happened to be a writer for Laugh-In, and would take them to Mexico on trips. He was part of their church or something, you know, it's a Catholic church. Jack had 8 kids, you know, and a wife named Rosemarie, and he was Irish, so he was Catholic, obviously. But when I went to meet Jack, he had lunch with, he was from Ohio, he was from Cleveland.
Living out here.
And I was thinking, you know, here's a guy from Ohio, and he's living out here, and he's writing comedy for television, and in fact, later that year, he won Emmy, he and his partner, Phil Hahn, won Emmys for writing, and so that was my first, and I figured, well, you know, he's just a guy like me, wears pants, he wears a shirt, and I could do this. And actually, that's when I first went over to Laugh-In. Jack took me over there, and then I hung around, and he had to go write, and I figured out how I could sneak into Laugh-In, because the first apartment we got, we ended up in Burbank, right down from NBC. Because, you know, if you remember Laugh-In, they always talked about beautiful downtown Burbank. So I just figured, here, that's showbiz for me. I'll live in Burbank. But I could go down.
Is that where the phrase beautiful downtown Burbank came from? Laughlin?
Okay. Oh, yeah, from Laughlin. Because they were shooting in Burbank, which is where NBC is.
Sure.
And then they would say, you know, coming to you from beautiful downtown Burbank.
Okay. Huh. Because other people have used that since then.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's become a thing, I guess. Is yeah. Just beautiful downtown. It's kind of a, you know, facetious kind of thing.
Isn't it? Right. Beautiful. Right, yeah.
But actually, it's nice. I've always liked Burbank. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyway, so I was telling you about John Rappaport, who was a writer. This was after Phil had gone. Phil then was working for Andy Williams' variety show. Andy Williams, who's also from Cincinnati.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I met John and met the Laughing guys. I was 24 at that time, I think. I had realized by then that, in my mind, the three things you needed to make it as a writer in TV were a spec script, a partner, and an agent. And mm-hmm. so I set about to do those things, to get an agent. I knew enough not to go after an agent too soon. I didn't. I knew I didn't have anything that was really ready to mm-hmm. to read and get judged by.
Were you writing all this time?
I was writing. Yeah, I would write start out writing Smothers Brothers scripts. You know, there was no script to see. I would just watch the show, and I'd even write who the guests were and all that kind of stuff. You know.
Okay.
But as I've
just practice or whatever, or?
Well, that's all I knew to do. Yeah, to start writing like that, and but it's as I you know I've done some teaching at USC as I mentioned. But I always tell my students, you know, the hardest thing's not writing a script; it's the hardest thing's getting somebody to read it.
The USC, you mentioned that to me before we started recording, but that was
right.
That came
this
much later
this
on.
Comes later, but I mean, yeah. Students, I tell them, you know, that's the hardest thing is not writing a script; it's getting somebody to read it. So it's hard to.
Right. Okay.
Eventually, though, I didn't want agents to read and say, "Oh yeah, I've read that guy. I know what he seems like." When it wasn't really what I wanted. It wasn't good yet. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I went in those 4 years. I went to a number of this place called Sherwood Oaks Experimental College, which Gary Shusett, who ran that, he would have a lot of people, like everybody from Paul Newman to George Carlin. He had to get real people come and you'd hear him talk. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Paul Newman saying, when people in the audience are asking Paul Newman what advice he would give to young writers,
mm-hmm.
I mean to young actors,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "Don't get your break too soon."
Oh, really?
And that always made sense to me. It's like don't be pushing it, and don't you know be ready before you have money in a bank before you write a check or whatever. So when I got the feeling that I was ready now, and I was like 25 at the time, I showed some material to an agent. He agreed to represent. And then I went looking for a partner. Sherwood Oaks College that I mentioned, Sherwood Oaks experimental thing, it was like, mm-hmm. I saw where they had a comedy writing workshop. In those days, a comedy writing workshop was just not something that appealed to me because the workshop sounded like a, you know, kind of some kind of group thing and you're working at it and all that kind of thing. But I thought mm-hmm. maybe I'll meet a guy there or somebody who, like a partner. And that's how I went there for. And when everybody said their names, I remember Mike Milligan, who became a partner, he was when he got around to introduce himself, he introduced himself and said he had just had an article rejected by the National Lampoon,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was funny because one, I read the National Lampoon religiously, that was my kind mm-hmm. of humor, and secondly, the fact that he had the what's it called? The self-deprecation, you know, which is a comedy writer's trait. And, and he actually completed an article and submitted it. So he had some ambition. So I went up, you know, just myself and basically said, you know, I'm not looking for friends. I'm looking for a partner that you want to trade some stuff. So next week we each brought something. I read his article that he wrote for National Lampoon. He read my stand-up stuff and we decided we'd write a script together. So, the guy who was an instructor for that class, Harvey Miller, happened to be the writer and producer of Odd Couple, so we wrote an Odd Couple script together. Mm-hmm. That was the first script Mike and I wrote together, and so now I was on my
Did
way to having.
Up,
I had an agent. I introduced Mike to the agent. We had an agent, and we had a spec script, and we showed it to Harvey Miller, and he was not, you know, we would have liked this Harvey to say, "Hey, this will be our next Odd Couple show," but that, of course, didn't happen.
No, it didn't.
No, it's not that easy. So This was the first script we ever wrote, but we had to learn this.
Did he give you any feedback on it or anything?
Yeah, he basically said, he wasn't bad or whatever, this, that, or the other, you know, but nothing's perfect. And you come to learn ever did, which has been a few years from then, that I really realized. I mean, if you're doing a show, the people that are doing your show, if you're trying to write it as a freelance writer, you don't want to do that because you're not going to hit the mark. You're not going to. Mm-hmm. They know their show so well that your script is not.
They know what works. They know the form. Yeah, there's like a formula almost.
They know exactly. They know the characters well. They know. It's just something you learn.
They don't publish that. They don't. It's not like you can't go read it in a manual. You just kind of have to just know it.
You'd have to just experience the show. And especially in those days. Nowadays, you can get scripts, you know, just on the internet. You can find scripts from different shows. But it was hard. One reason we wrote Aka, we managed to get a couple scripts from Harvey. So we at least had a script to know what a script looks like. And we wrote an Odd Couple. And another thing, good thing to do was script-wise, that was an audience show, a three-camera show, you know, and we also did a MASH, which is a single-camera show and a single. Mm-hmm. So it's a good balance for a portfolio. And then it was still from the time Mike and I decided to become writing partners, which was on St. Patrick's Day.
Why would you partner with somebody, though? Why not just do it yourself?
Because you learn really fast. That, like for Phil and Han, I mentioned Jack Hanrahan and his partner, Phil. Mm-hmm. You move faster. You just see that it makes common sense that you get paid half because you'll split the money, but people like to hire partners, you know, like to hire teams. I know when I got, we can get to that later when I get in. I mean, if I had scripts on my desk, I'm going to pick up a script with two guys' names on it before I pick up one guy's name because it's less likely that one of them might not be crazy and that they'll... comedy's the kind of thing, really, that you want somebody to bounce it off of, you know? You sit in a room by yourself and you're writing, you don't know if something's funny, you know?
Right.
You know, if you tell a joke in the woods and nobody laughs, is it funny? I mean, you don't know.
Right. So you could bounce ideas off.
Yeah,
were there writing sessions in funny or were you guys laughing at each other all the time?
Well, we would laugh and we would argue and we would all this. I think two rules we made right from the start is one, if one of us hates something like a joke, one of us says, I hate it, then we just move on.
Okay.
No more discussion. And the other joke is we never disagree in front of others. You know, it's kind of the Godfather rule. You know, you yell like two Irishmen if you want, but when we're pitching stories or one thing, we never show any disagreement between us.
Right.
You know?
So where's he from then?
He grew up out here. Mike grew up out here. His father was from Cincinnati.
Oh,
that's
really?
Another coincidence. His father was. Grew up in Cincinnati.
Is your partner Mike Milligan?
My partner Mike Milligan. Bernie Milligan actually, I believe, was a bat boy for the 1919 Reds in Cincinnati.
And you guys just randomly met here. That's
we just met at this class. Had he ever been to Cincinnati then?
Or
I don't know if he was, if he had been to Cincinnati or not. He grew up out here.
Mm-hmm.
He was, he's my age. He was like 6 months younger. He was
married, he not around anymore?
Married to his high, no, he still is around, but he's he had two kids just like me, about the same age. Only his kids were boys, and my two were girls.
Okay.
He had married his high school sweetheart.
He's
married right out of school too. So we had a lot in common that way, and our sense of humor was similar.
Are you guys writing jokes around family life and stuff?
Well,
that kind of stuff,
when you're writing, then when you here's what happened. You know, I was, in fact, this actually before I met Mike. I mentioned coming out here to write Laugh In and Smothers Brothers, which is called Variety Comedy. 1971 summer, I saw a thing called All in the Family. And I saw this on TV, and it's like Archie Bunker. There's this guy, he's saying Chink, and he's saying Spick, and Jungle Bunny, and Jigaboo.
Yeah.
Jesus, this is television, you know,
it's
and this is satire, and it's on TV. And that was the relevant kind of comedy I would love this is what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So my thing changed right then when I saw that. It's like this is what I want to do is write. Well, who does this? Norman Lear. Okay, I want to do Norman Lear.
Mm-hmm.
When my parents came out a short time after that, I took
was it already a big deal by that point?
Well, it just that summer it was such a big deal. When you saw it, it became a big hit. It was kind of Carol O'Connor did an interview actually on local TV and was saying, I just did this turkey, and it was just like it was a throwaway show, but it caught on so big that it became, you know, eventually it became a number one show. But I took my parents to see a taping of it at CBS. I had never been to a taping before.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Lear did the warm-up. Watch the taping. The whole show just blew me away. It's the first time I ever realize you could write comedy and something that was drama. You know, you could be laughing 1 minute and tears in your eyes the next minute. Mm-hmm. The way that show combined the topics, you know, it's all...
It was groundbreaking for the time, wasn't it?
It just was something that I didn't know you could get away with doing as a comedy that had, you know... But that to me was that's what I wanted to do. What I would call
relevant the show. So you, did you get on that show then?
Well, here's what I did.
Okay.
I thought this was great. I felt like jumping over the rail and going tell Norman I want to work for you. But fortunately, I wasn't stupid enough to do that. And I thought I might break a leg or something. So I went. I wrote a treatment for an All in the Family episode.
Now what's it? What's a treatment?
Well, that's a good question. It's just like. Narrative pages, so like 8 or 10 pages of just here's what happens. Okay.
No lines or anything like
that. No, you're probably good to include a few jokes or something, but I realized later that's something you don't do, so I don't want to mention this is not a good idea for anybody. Don't write treatments. Nobody reads treatments. But at the time I didn't know that, so I figured I didn't have an actual All in the Family script. I couldn't get it. So I wrote a story. The story was basically called The Draft Dodger, and it was, you know, a big thing at that time was, you know, the war in Vietnam and guys going draft. So the story I wrote was basically Meathead, you know, Meathead's friend who's, mm-hmm. went to school with his draft guy, living in Canada, comes back, his mom's sick at Christmas time, he comes back to visit his mom. He ends up going over to say hi to Meathead at Meathead's house, it's Christmas, they invite him to stay. Meathead and Gloria invite him to stay for Christmas dinner. He ends up at the Bunker's house for Christmas dinner. So here's this draft dodger at Archie's house on Christmas dinner. And Archie says like, oh, you live in Canada, huh? So you a hockey player or a draft dodger? And just kind of joking, you know. And then there's a subject of like I was writing the thing where Jesus is, you know, it's Christmas time. And would Jesus fight in Vietnam if he were drafted and that kind of thing? And I thought this would be a good, so I knew a gal who was an agent at that time when I'd, and she had seen some of my stuff and agreed that she would like represent me if I wanted. I asked her to send this to All in the Family. So she did send it to All in the Family. It was like a month later, I heard they passed, you know, which is common word you hear. Mm-hmm. So that thing was buried. And this was before I actually met Mike. Then once we got writing, that All in the Family thing was, you know, that exists no more. It comes to life later if you want the story. Basically, Mike and I don't know how much of the story you want to hear, but the first thing Mike and I, our agent sent us on was a meeting with Sid and Marty. You know, Sid and Marty Croft did Saturday morning shows. I don't know if you remember any of those.
Like what shows?
The H.R. Puffin stuff and what was the band about? Banana Splits. I think Jack Hanrahan actually created Banana Splits and show.
Okay.
But we met with Sid Croft. Sid Croft was, he's like the Hanna-Barbera. So Mike and I are going to sit down. He says, you know, I was thinking in my backyard the other day, where'd all the witches go when they retire? And, you know, we look at it, well, we don't know where they go. So he says, well, you know where they go? They go to this, it's an old movie studio. It's not in use. Nobody's there anymore, but there's three witches live there. And one of them's Witchy Poo. We didn't know who Witchy Poo is. Apparently, Witchy Poo is a character on H.R. Puffin stuff. So he says, "Here, let me show you the show." So he takes us to a room and has a projector there and turns on this H.R. Puffin stuff and leaves us there in the room to watch H.R. Puffin stuff. And there's
You thinking now, like, why am I watching H.R.?
Well, I look when I'm watching it because there are trees that are sneezing and talking flutes and it's just all this craziness. And then we look over, you know, in those days, there were reels of film that were on the film.
Yeah.
And the film's going off the reel and onto the floor. And it's continuing to go on the floor, you know. Uh-huh. So I go to the door and I'm looking down the hall and I say, here, anybody, you know, nobody was here. And Mike finally gets a brilliant idea, Milligan, and he pulls the cord out of the wall. So, and then we look around and at least the projector stopped. Nobody's there. And I say, you know, we don't do this stuff. Anyway, let's get out of here. So we just took off. And then I called our agent. I said, you know, Lou, we don't want to do the Saturday morning stuff, you know. We want to write primetime television. And I remember he said at the time, you know, you guys belong at MTM. MTM was Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart.
Yeah.
And I said, no, we want to write for Norman Lear. And so to Lou's credit, about a month later, he called up. We had a meeting with Don Nickel and Mickey Ross and Bernie West, who worked with Norman, basically were the key writers for the All in the Family that he was doing. Mm-hmm. And they had won Emmys and done all this work with Norman Lear. Mm-hmm. And they were doing All in the Family, and he got us a meeting. So we got to go over. Mike and I went to CBS. We met with Don, Mickey, and Bernie. We went over to Farmer's Market, which is next door, for lunch. We had a great time. Got along with the guys, told them it's the only show we really wanted to write for, and it's the best show on TV and all that. Got mm-hmm. back, talked to our agent. Our agent said, they were going on hiatus then. It was right at the end of the season when you're going on hiatus and uh-huh. you're looking for. And he said, when they get back, they are probably going to give you an assignment or two when they get back.
Uh-huh.
So we said, well, assignment, heck, we want to write on staff. Because we'd already written, this was after we had written The Good Times. I never told you about that. Mm. But the basic thing, I guess it's maybe of interest to any aspiring writers out there, we wrote a Good Times episode. It was based on a...
And that was also Norman Lear.
That was Norman, but yeah, we hadn't met Norman at that point. We happened to be a show. It was actually the first black family ever on TV, which yeah. was Good Times. Mike and I had seen a couple episodes that had just come on, and our agent said, yeah, they're looking for stories over there, you know. If you write like three stories, and you know, so we just wrote like three little paragraphs of stories. One of them, I'd been reading Psychology Today magazine. There was an article about William Shockley, who's a Nobel Prize winner, who had this theory that that blacks are innately inferior IQ wise to white people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a black professor who's at Washington University in St. Louis who came up with a black intelligence test that white people fail. So if you give, it's a cultural really? Thing was his point.
Okay.
And basically Norman loved that story idea. And Alan Mannings, who was exec producing the show, and Jackie Ellenson and Norman Paul, who were writers. They had written for George Burns and these kind of guys, you know, and a well-known crew. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we got an assignment. So what that taught me was the way you get an assignment for a TV is you come up with a story they want to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you let them work out the story with you, and they give you notes, and then you go write the first, you write a narrative, which is a story outline, it's called, mm-hmm. and then they give you notes on that, and then you go write the first draft. And then you turn that in, and you get notes on that. And then you go write the second draft, and then you turn that in, and then you get paid. You get paid in story outline and first draft, second draft, and that's how that works.
Hmm.
And we had that, and then we didn't sell another script for like a year, and then we actually got things going where we, I won't bore you with the facts, but we Chico and the Man, we end up writing mm-hmm. in an episode, a new show called Joe and Sons, and things start happening. So we
are you kind of then giddy at this point? Like it's like hey, it's
well,
you know,
after the Good Time, we were literally I think we were walking on air when we left that Good Times office with the first assignment. Say, well, you guys mm-hmm. got an assignment, so that was really
then is
that
the
was
wife,
that was cool.
The wife and the...
So we started moving, but then we got a letter. I don't know if it's because of our Good Times thing or what, was inviting us, Mike and I, to pitch for a new series. It was the Jeffersons. You know, it had mm-hmm. just come on. So we went and met with Don Mickey. Well, we didn't meet with Don Mickey and Bernie. The two, Gordon Mitchell and Lloyd Turnell, who were the story editors. There was just the three, Don Mickey and Bernie, and then these two story editors.
Mm-hmm.
And we went and met with them. We pitched stories. By now, we had learned how to pitch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We'd usually pitch at least three stories. We'd work up three stories before we went in. And then we'd have other notion ideas in case they didn't like any of the stories. But one of the stories we pitched, I'd read in the, I remember reading in Time magazine about, it was becoming a trend for adopted kids to track down their families, which you couldn't track down your parents before this.
Okay.
Started happening.
So you got a lot of your ideas in by like reading newspapers and magazines?
Yeah, that's where you get them all, especially with all those shows were very topical, you know?
So this former... former, maybe sometimes current journalist. That's interesting. You read the papers and the magazines, and that's where you get your storylines.
Yeah, Time magazine, Rolling Stone, anything that has topical stories.
That's where you get
especially if you're writing for like Jefferson's, which you would call a black family, and same with Good Times. You look for ideas that have to do with black culture, or whatever.
Okay.
But so to take that adoptive thing, I was thinking, how do you translate that to Jefferson's? And well, what if a girl shows up and says she's Louise's daughter, you know?
Oh,
so that's
wow.
what we that's what we pitched, and that happened to be the same time that George was in the Navy, because we knew George Jefferson was in the Navy, and Lloyd and Gordon liked the idea. I mean, they said, we'll pitch it. The way that works when you pitch the story editors, and they have to run everything by the exec producers. And then so anyway, we got a call back that the exec producers, who were Don Meek and Bernie.
Do you worry about them stealing your idea then or anything?
Nah,
or?
You can't worry about that.
Does that happen?
No. I mean, I can tell you a case where it happened with us, but I won't go into that now.
Okay. But you don't really worry about it?
No, you can't worry about that. It's like a friend of mine once said, don't die with your secret. You know, you can't worry about it, because mainly nobody's going to really steal that idea. If you come up with an idea and you've got some kind of writing, they'll just have you write it. I mean, why not?
Because somebody's got to do it, right?
They're going to rewrite it. The whole thing's going to be rewritten.
Okay.
The way it works in there, like I say in my book, I explain that it's once you get on staff, you realize what it's like. It's all about rewriting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the thing I forgot to mention that might be of interest to writers is when we went to that Good Time, you know, we wrote the Good Time show.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote first draft, second right. draft. We go see it. The first couple of minutes, we're going, when we're with the wrong show. You know, we don't recognize anything from the stuff we've written. And then finally, you see a sign that says, Happy Birthday, Michael. And we knew it was Michael's birthday when we wrote it. So it must be the same show. But it was the same structure, but it was all different lines. I mean, it was like, you know, there may be three lines of ours that were in there of jokes.
But you get paid for it.
And we got paid for it. And we got a name, you get credit for it. So it said written by us.
Okay.
And I remember afterwards, like going with my wife at the time to a volleyball. We used to play volleyball every Monday or whatever. And people saying, oh, I saw your show, you know, and I knew this line was your line. You know, I was you. I heard it. This wasn't our line at all. You know, it's like, yeah, what do you say? Well, that wasn't me.
You just accept it and say thank you.
Yeah. What do you say?
But so you're doing this episode where Lucille.
Louise. Yeah. So they liked your story, right? So we go back and meet with Lloyd and Gordon, who are the story editors. Now, meanwhile, we've had this meeting with Dominic and Bernie a couple of years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of blew us off then, you know, like you guys are talented, but not our show. So we didn't know how that was going to sit with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't even know how we got in. It was Lloyd and Gordon who wrote this letter about inviting us to pitch. But we went in, and they gave us, how did that work? Whenever you take a second meeting on the same story, then that's an assignment. They have to, by guild rules, you have to sign. So we talked up a story, and then we went, Mike and I, and wrote our story outline, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we come back, story outline, you get notes on that, and then you write your first draft. I remember writing our first draft in... Mike and I had family at home, so we got a room at Sportsman's Lodge, which is a motel thing here, and we write our first draft. And I remember
Got away from the family for a little bit.
And the night before we had to turn it in, we're there typing the thing in the room, and we had the Jeffersons on. They just happened to be on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember George saying, aha, you know, he says, the heart of Louise or something. So I just type in the script, you know, and I thought, you know, I typed three of them, aha, aha, aha. And she says, don't you aha me, you know, aha you if I want. I just took off on that, what I'd see it on TV, you know, but all writing our own stuff. Anyway, we turned that in the first draft.
Yeah.
And then they had a call. Lou called and said, Dominic and Bernie want to meet with you, you know. And so we didn't know if we were going to meet with Lloyd and Gordon and Dominic and Bernie. We got there. It was just Dominic and Bernie and Mike and I. And then they didn't, you know, it was nothing like, they didn't say anything about it when we had lunch before. They just right away started giving us notes, right?
Huh.
And we didn't know if it was good or bad that Lloyd and Lord aren't here. Anyway, we took their notes.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to write a second draft, and then we came back again and met with them. Then he offered us a job. We had also been offered a job writing to write on staff for Joe and Sons, which was another show. But
another Norman Lear show?
It was a new show. That's a whole other story.
You can read
about it all in the book.
Okay.
But
go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, that to me was a big. Here are the guys that we had hoped to work for, you know, and now all of a sudden we were on staff writing for a Norman Lear show. So that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us too, they said, don't talk to any other writers, just talk to us. So we were feeling pretty good about that. And then a year later, just to wrap up kind of this all in the family question, After we had been writing for Jeffersons for a year, and we had met with Norman, and we knew Norman and everything, and we finished the one season, all the shows are done, and I was realizing once you're done with one season, you're picked up for 24, just like All in the Family's, they're going to need 24 new shows.
Yeah.
And just like, we're going to need them. And I'm thinking, you know, that idea about the draft dodger, you know, it was the timing then. Jimmy Carter was president, and it was a big issue about should they give amnesty to draft dodgers or not. Okay. It was a real political thing.
Yeah, right.
And I just thought, this is, you know, I'm going to try a pitch to Norman. And so we set up a meeting to meet with Norman. Mike and I were going to go, but Mike turned out I had a dentist appointment. And he said, well, just go, you know, I knew the store, so I'll go to myself. So I just, me and Norman, I pitched it to Norman. And, you know, he says, he loves the story. He took me out. J.D. Joe was his secretary. We walk out into our office of J.D. He says, J.D.J. just gave us a reason for doing the next season. And this was Norman Lear telling me.
Wow.
And I was like blown away, you know.
Yeah.
Was, boy, I want to put that on my tombstone, you know.
Right.
But
I hear, so you, the guy that you idolized, now just basically giving you high praise.
Well, it was incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a rare moment. And it was great, and of course we had, you know.
And plus, now you're an idol, but he's like,
this is the way you say, you know, Norman knew us, and he knew we were, you know, whatever. And in fact, after our first meeting,
he wasn't just a big deal to you; he's a big deal to a lot of people. He's still a legend. Yeah,
he's still alive. You know, he's 96,
and he's a legend. I mean, he's a legend among.
He's still my. He's everything you would think. And in the
book, still know him? You still?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I've seen him like twice in a past couple of years. He's wrote his own book and everything.
How long did you work on the Jeffersons then?
Well, it was through the seventh season.
Uh-huh.
So we started out as writers. We were like the lowest guys on the totem pole.
Yeah.
And we ended up exec producing the show, running the last 2 years we ran the whole show.
Did it just go seven seasons? Or?
No, it went. We left after seven seasons because we got an offer to do development where we could get the same pay we were getting and just have to think up ideas. So we thought,
really?
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
But anyway, we thought,
so
I always
you
thought.
You know how many seasons it went?
It went 11 seasons.
It set a record.
At the time, it was the longest running sitcom ever in the history of TV.
Wow.
So
okay.
We feel like we were careful to leave it with guys who knew what they were doing. In fact, included in the writers we left it to, Peter Casey and David Lee, that was their first job. We hired them on. They went on to write and produce Cheers, and then they created Wings, and they created Frasier, you know, and Frasier won the Emmy for best comedy series.
Yeah, so you had a pretty good eye for those guys.
So those guys, we hired them off of a spec script that we liked. And they were delivering.
And then they were off to the races
Well, they spent 6 years there.
So are you like their hero then?
I don't know if they want to even admit that they wrote for the Jeffersons now, because they wrote for such high, you know, their shows are well, I'll leave it at that. But anyway,
they're big shows. But yeah, but Jefferson's was nothing to sneeze at.
Jefferson's, like I say, it was the longest running show there. In fact, it's an iconic. They just did a documentary a couple of years ago. It's on Unsung. If you look up Unsung Hollywood, it's the documentary, and they really kind of put the show into perspective. It's
are you in
the documentary?
Then?
Yeah, they interviewed me and Norman and my partner. The interviews were like an hour and 2 hours a piece, but they're just little clips of us in there. But they start off with footage from the racial stuff, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, the marches down south and all that kind of stuff. And you know, it's interesting. When in the book, one of my main dedication in the book,
Before we get to do, I'm curious of these two episodes you brought up about Louise and Gavin, the kid looking for their adoptive parents, and then this episode with the the draft dodger.
All in the Family.
Did these ever get made into episodes?
Sure.
They did. Okay.
They were what would happen, and I think in Steve Hoffman's article that you were referring to before.
The Inquirer, the guy before John Keyswater, for context.
He writes that was in 76, I think, and Mike and I wrote the Christmas episodes for both shows. We wrote the Christmas episode. It was the original episode we wrote for the Jeffersons and for All in the Family. So this episode was a Christmas episode of All in the Family. And it was interesting about the All in the Family, the draft dodger thing. I thought we pretty much presented it so most people kind of side with Archie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with Meathead.
Yeah,
you know,
Rob Reiner's character.
Yeah,
Mike.
Kid,
right?
Yeah, and gee, the mail was 50-50. I mean, it's like 50 people said, you know, you tell it like it is, Meathead, and the other 50% was right on Archie.
I'd be curious to ask you about that because you touched on something. I was thinking a question. I read an article a while back. that there was talk about how All in the Family was groundbreaking because it took this guy. It was this, you called it satire earlier, and it took this guy who was this, you know, out and out racist, and then you got Rob Reiner, who's the peacenik with this Gloria, and you know, and Edith is the trying to balance it all and kind of looks bumbling, I guess, in the whole thing. And then people look at it as like this earth, you know, changing kind of thing. And I guess they related it to like Stephen Colbert when he did the not the current show on CBS, but the the Colbert Report, where he was doing like kind of making fun of Bill O'Reilly on Fox News. And people loved All in the Family because it was like earth shattering and changing. And then the same, you take the other half of people watch it because it confirmed what they believe.
Right. Yeah.
So where do you land on that? That's
fascinating.
Did you ever think that when you were on the show? Did you guys, you called it satire and then some people looked at it and said, well, that's no, right. Archie's right.
Well, I don't know.
Where do you land on that?
Well, I think I would land, you know, okay. Well, for instance, one of the first episodes I remember seeing was where Archie says he refers to Chinese guys as chink, and Meathead tries to point out, you know, that's kind of a slur to somebody chink, and he says, but besides something like besides Archie, you know, the guy's not even Chinese. He's Japanese. And Archie says, oh, yeah, so you can tell the difference between a Chinese guy and a Japanese guy? And Meathead says, yeah. And he says, yeah, you'd say, hey, which one of you is the chink and which is the Jap? I mean, how can you not how can you not look at that as satire? I mean, if you think that that's just Archie, that's the way you should talk, then I don't know what to say to you, you know?
Right.
But so a lot of people, though, that's, yeah.
But just so you don't think people on the show ever thought of it anything other than satire?
Well, I'll tell you this. Carol O'Connor is very much a liberal guy, so he's not like Archie.
Which was interesting,
and so is Edith, the actress, and so are these people. So, you know.
They wouldn't have Mike done it if they thought it was confirming. Okay.
I don't know. You tell me. I mean, if racism is good, I mean, here's Archie, but you make fun. For instance, Sammy Davis, when Sammy Davis did All in the Family, mm-hmm. you know, and Archie always, you know, he talks about, you know, he's whether you're anything that Archie's not is something to make fun of as far as he's concerned. You know, he's mm-hmm. white anyway.
So, but I guess you can't, once you put it out in the world.
But Sammy Davis, when Sammy Davis, you know, Archie's bragging about the fact that he had driven the cab and Sammy Davis was in it. Sammy Davis actually left his briefcase. He's coming over to pick it up and everything's good until they're going to take a picture. The news showed up, Archie and Sammy Davis together, and Sammy Davis kisses his cheek when they take the picture.
Yeah, right. I remember that. Yeah.
And of course, Archie's look and the audience react. I mean, we all know this. What a guy like Archie, you know, who's basically a racist, who's a bigot.
Yeah.
He just kind of like, you know. And if you watch the show, I don't see how there's any way to think about things. But Norman would present things like they did a show where one of Edith's relatives dies and turns out that she's gay, she's lesbian, and lives with another woman. And Archie never connected that the two women happened to be.
Right. Uh-huh.
You know, and you learned a lot by watching. You know, if you grew up in Ohio, you're watching and you're learning about there are people out there that are living a little differently from you, and they're real people. Uh-huh. And they're human beings, and they deserve to be, you know.
But if somebody interprets it differently, that's not your fault.
You tell me. I don't know. I think it's definitely. You know, I went to college, and I consider myself a. You know, I was Jesuit educated, and even though they, well, anyway, it seems to me that you know, it's pretty obvious. But
okay, interesting. But, well, that's good. I'm glad to get your opinion on that.
But it's a good point because it was new to me to find out like it's this All in the Family thing that we've got. There was one guy that wrote, you know, I put in the book, print the whole review, and it just said, I just watched the worst television show I ever watched, and he was talking about the Draft Dodger show, you know? And he just got to saying how terrible it was that that we would have a Draft Dodger be there with Archie, and then I put another letter, typical of some of the fan letter we got that said just the opposite. I just watched the best show I ever saw on television. So, you know, it shows you where the split, it was polarization.
If you guys are writing it, are you thinking we're trying to change public opinion? Is that part of the discussion?
Well, I don't know. Tell me, what is satire to you? What does satire mean? For instance, if you did English,
I think the journalist's response is, "I'm answering the questions here, right?" No,
oh, yeah.
but that's a good question.
If you
put me on this.
I don't know what your major is, but you're a journalist, and
psych major.
You remember Jonathan Swift wrote
Gulliver's Travels.
Yeah, but he also wrote, what was the piece he wrote, A Modest Proposal, that was about, there was a political kind of piece on England, and he proposed eating babies. You know, you eat babies, right, and this would solve the situation. Well, mm-hmm, this is obviously,
right,
he's writing satire.
Sure.
And I don't know. I think this, at the most, you know what, I think what Norman would tell you that he wasn't trying to send any message, never was. It's about entertainment.
But is he saying
it's about comedy?
I think I've heard him say that.
Yeah, he'll tell you that.
Is that a cop out?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to call.
Well, you don't want to call your friend
Norman's.
Yeah.
No, but Norman definitely drove this stuff. What Norman did, he wanted. I compared. I had experience with writing. Mike and I wrote a pilot for Aaron Spelling. I don't know if you know Aaron Spelling. At
sure.
the time, he was like the king of hour shows, and Norman was the king of half hour. And I compared Norman, and when we first met Aaron, Mike said to me, "Who does he remind you of?" And I said, "Norman, he's that kind of presence. You know, he's a kind of one of a kind. If he's in a room, man, you know he's in a room."
Right.
But Aaron, I compare the difference between Aaron Spelling, basically, to cut to the chase with Aaron Spelling, he was doing Charlie's Angels. We happened to be at his house when the Charlie's Angels, the mail came, and it was on the cover of Time magazine. The butler brings in the magazine, and so we look at Charlie's Angels, and it said in there about TNA and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he said that, fellas, says my dad was a tailor. This is Aaron Spelling, and my guy comes in to get a suit, and he says, "I want a green suit." My dad didn't say, "You look better in a blue suit, or a brown suit would fit you." You know, he said, "My dad wanted a green suit. He make him a green suit." He says, "I give the networks they want TNA. I give them what they want."
And that was Spelling.
But
that wasn't.
He said
so much
his
later.
Favorite show was a show called, and to give credit to Aaron Spelling, he said it was a show called Family, if you remember, which was not a TNA show. And he said, "That's really the kind of stuff I want to do." But
Was that Family in the '70s? Was that?
It was at the same time. Yeah,
okay.
I think it was in the same time that Family was on, because we ended up writing a pilot for him, and he said he wanted to make it kind of like Family. But
so you're saying Spelling gave him what they wanted,
and Norman gives them what he thinks they need. So Norman gives people what they think they need, and he makes them think. So Norman will give you something that you'll think about.
Yeah.
Like I remember writers coming down from All in the Family, a couple of them, and they're at the water fountain, they're complaining about, as they get their water, so what's the matter? Oh, he wants Archie to take uppers now, Uppers, so Norman would say he'd deal with drugs. He'd make people think, He'd give you something. And you remember they did a show where Edith is raped, How do you make that a comedy?
Oh, I remember. Oh, that was huge.
And it's like, so Norman, I don't know if he's trying to, he definitely would have to admit he wants to make people think, because these are things you didn't see on half-hour television.
No.
Everybody recognizes that he changed half-hour television.
So it's just by the very stories he was telling.
Yeah.
That's
the reason that they're doing this live thing we're talking about. They're recasting with a live Jefferson's episode.
Is this just a one-off thing?
It's a one-off for now. Jamie Foxx is playing George Jefferson. Woody Harrelson's playing
Archie
Bunker. They're going to do, supposedly, they say in the trades, an episode of each. But I think my guess would be they're going to do, there was an hour-long episode when they spun off the show where you saw both Archie. My guess would be they'll try to get Jamie Foxx in and Woody Harrelson together, and that would be done in this other show.
That's going to be fascinating, especially in this environment these days.
Marissa Tomei is playing Edith Bunker, and Jefferson's, I think Wanda Sykes is playing Louise. And
Names associated with this.
The white guy, Tom Willis, the honky?
Yeah.
Will Ferrell's going to play that.
Really?
So I think it's going to be...
Yeah, Franklin Cover, right?
It's going to be interesting. Franklin Cover played that, Will Ferrell, of course, is Will Ferrell.
Sure.
So it'll be interesting to see how it plays. I think Sony wants to do this. They think that those shows are meaningful even today, and that they'd like to redo the same, as I understand it, use the same scripts, but recast.
Are they going to do a satire of the satire, or are they going to do a straight, another episode with
They're going to do an episode. As I understand, they're going to do episodes.
It's not like
an original thing.
Chips was a show I loved.
Mad Magazine doing the Jeffersons or something, which they've done. But no, I think it's it's interesting. What I was going to tell you about even dedication of the book. I mean, when I was I went to St. Xavier, where I went to X school, all white, all white kids. So my all white classroom, young black man came in to the Jesuits' credit, I guess they set him up to come in. And he spoke to our class.
Oh, he wasn't a student. He was just
He was about 20-something. And he said, you know, when I was a kid and growing up in the 50s, I didn't see anybody. The only people I saw look like me on TV were when I was watching Tarzan, you know. And it'd be the natives in the jungle, and they'd be chasing Tarzan. And I'd be saying, look out, Tarzan, you know, they're right behind you. Run. Uh-huh. When I should have been yelling, get that honky. And it just hit me, you know. I'm sorry. If I were a black kid, it's
this
like...
This guy said this at St. X?
Yeah. He's black and he's educating us. And I mean, he's come to just to talk to us.
Uh-huh.
And it was eye-opening to me when I'm saying, you know, because I'm young, I think, you know, I didn't choose being white.
Did he say it to be funny, though? I mean, it was a funny but thought-provoking...
Well, what do you think? I don't know. Okay. I laughed. Okay. I mean, it depends on how you take it.
Yeah, sure.
I certainly
Just laugh now when you said it.
And I find out now, actually, when I watch Klansman, that's not the first time that... Did you see the Black Klansman?
I actually have it on the iPad sitting right in front of me. I haven't watched it yet.
An eye-opening thing for me, and I really had to think. You know, what if I grew up in the '50s and whatever color I was, I didn't see anybody look like that on TV. It's like a whole different experience for me. And so when I found out there were, you know, black shows like so-called Black Norman Lear's doing and stuff, that's just really just the fact that we had a black family on TV, a loving family, a family with money, you know, that you don't see, they're not a poor family like it was on Good Times, and see there's an interracial couple that every week you see an interracial marriage working, you know, the two work. The very first letter we get, which is reprinted in the book, is from a guy in Louisiana saying, you know, Marxist producers, writers exchanging spittle, the two white people, different color skin, kissing each other, you know, and it's all about just terrible, how terrible this is, you know. But he's writing their letter every week, so he's watching. So
yeah,
Isabel Louise Jefferson, you know, after a run through one day, says, "Well, why don't we call him and thank him for watching the show?" So we all got on these phones in the hall, you know. Those days you had to push buttons, and everybody gets on. I had the whole cast and Mike and I and different people on the phone from.
And this guy just sent a letter.
Got a hold of this guy's phone number in Louisiana and called him. And he said, hello, Isabel, says, is this Mr. Greer? Yes, who's this? He says, this is Louise Jefferson. You know, we just wanted to call you and thank you for watching our show. And, you know, it's like silence on the other end, you know. And he says, you know, we can send you a cast picture if you'd like. You know, and it's just silence. Uh-huh. And then Frank Cover, you know, the white guy, he says, I can send you a picture of Helen on my lap, if you like, you know.
And then
Mike says, we can send you a picture of Tom on Helen's lap. Everybody started breaking up, including
the guy on the phone.
No, he hung up.
Oh, really?
But we never got another letter from him again.
Oh, really? He sending you several letters or?
Oh yeah, yeah. It was several letters, and each one of them lists all the names of the sponsors, like Purina. Uh-huh. I remember was one of them, and a different sponsor. And he had copies to them.
Oh, really?
And he had copies to the producers of the show, copies to the network. It was like, you know, he was just so offended by seeing an interracial couple, a black and white people kissing on TV.
I wonder what happened to that guy.
I say that to point out how groundbreaking it was. You know, you didn't see here was an interracial marriage that worked. And I think, and a lot of people in their letters would write, say that they like the fact that, you know, there was this couple on, and that we treated it just like another couple. And I think that was so, you know, Norman deserves all the credit for those things he did. One of the writer producers, I was exec producer of Maude, Rod Parker, had a Christmas present for Norman, painted as a black man. So Norman had in his office a huge painting of Norman Lear as a black man.
Oh, really?
Which was kind of funny. But Norman, I think he'll be real modest about whether he changed TV or not, but everybody knows.
He did
the Kennedy Center thing a year or so ago, where he was awarded for his contribution. And he'll tell you, as he writes in his book, that he was one of the first when the TV Academy had their Hall of Fame or whatever it is. You know, he's one of the first guys. He and...
he should be.
Edward R. Murrow, whoever it was, the TV says, but when he called his mom, he told her, you know, mom, if, you know, he's Jewish family.
Yeah.
And said, mom, they, you know, I've selected to do. And his mom's response says, well, if that's what they want to do. And, so it's like,
Your family will always ground you, won't they?
I remember David Geffen's story about flying to his mom to a concert, you know, in a helicopter.
Uh-huh.
It was one of these, you know, like Woodstock or whatever it is, Coachella or whatever. And then his mom says, now, what exactly do you do with this group? You know, and he says, well, I manage their career. And she said, you?
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, parents.
That's funny.
Never get it. But
were your parents supportive of you?
I think they did. No, my dad certainly would have rather be a priest. I know that. I don't think they.
Or a stockbroker?
Hollywood. I don't know. You know, it was always a big issue if you're an English major. What are you going to do with an English major?
Uh-huh.
But they.
I used to have a T-shirt that says, I majored in liberal arts. Would you like fries with that?
Oh, yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
See, that's funny.
Yeah.
They were, I don't know.
But at some point, do they go?
You know, people in Ohio, at that time anyway, if you said California, they go, why is that a place to raise kids? You know, you want to raise your family in California?
Right.
You know, they think it's like everybody's running nude on the beach and taking drugs, you know? And now, ironically, I just read recently where Ohio is the number one state for opioid addiction in the country.
Everybody should move to California now, right?
They rank them now, yeah. So Ohio's taking first place with.
Yeah,
and we've had some personal knowledge of people who have died from opioid. Yeah, it's a terrible thing.
It's horrible. It's horrible.
And a good friend of the family who was he was out for a bike ride and he got hit on a car by a kid who just picked up his some drug heroin or whatever the hell he's taking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real issue, but.
So then you do this, we talked a lot about the Jeffersons, and I know we're kind of running out of time here a little bit, but the Jeffersons ended a long time ago. You went on to other stuff. What have you been doing in the interim here?
Well, after Jeffersons, we went into development, and that's a whole other part of the book that I keep mentioning.
We'll talk about that. We'll make sure we get people get your
book.
In the book
I mentioned to.
Which isn't out yet.
But what I'm saying is it ends with the Jeffersons where we go off and leave. And so book two, it's a trilogy. So book two of the trilogy is what we do next is go into development. And the title of that particular book is Development, Heaven, Hell, or Purgatory. So you learn mm-hmm. about developing scripts, which we did for a couple of years. And then we did a show called What's Happening Now.
Oh my gosh.
With,
yeah.
I don't know if you remember What's Happening. So it's when the guys grow up and they're married. Roger's married. That was Good Times. That was,
that
good,
was times, good Times.
The original Jimmy Walker is Good Times.
Was it Jimmy Walker on What's Happening Now?
No, that was Ernie Thomas who Ernie Thomas and Robert Guillaume actually were on the same episode of The Jeffersons.
Uh huh.
That was kind of their break. Did you mention Gary Coleman? Was he from Cincinnati or something?
No, I just mentioned because
his first episode, he did.
He was on Jeffersons, wasn't he?
Well, he did his premiere episode was on Jeffersons. Norman made a deal with him because he was doing some bank commercial or something. They saw this kid and he said he had put him on the Jeffersons as an episode to see how that worked. And then Different Strokes was developed for him.
Mm-hmm.
But we did Dear John with Judd Hirsch. I don't know if you remember.
Oh yeah, sure.
John
that was
on.
Show.
That's a show about a divorce group, you know. With
you, what would
with
you?
Judd.
What part did you play in that?
Yeah, we were writer producers.
Okay.
That show, and then we went on Royal Family. I think you mentioned before
was
a show.
What was the catchphrase
Red
of the
Fox.
Guy on What's Happening Now? That was the. I'm looking at this guy, the heavyset guy.
Well, that was rerun. Dwayne would go, hey, hey, hey.
Okay.
I remember Dwayne and always, hey, hey, hey.
Yeah. Didn't the rerun I mean, he's very iconic. What was his name? I'm trying to think.
Well, Fred Berry was the actor's name.
Okay.
And so Fred played Rerun, and Ernest Thomas, who's a wonderful actor, actually played Raj on the show.
Uh-huh.
You know, Raj, he had that certain kind of dance, the Raj dance.
Uh-huh. Did you write this kind of stuff into that, or...?
Well, like the dance?
Yeah.
That was something he did. You know, there was What's Happening was the original series, uh-huh. which was based on a movie called Cooley High. And then Columbia owned the rights and decided when first-run syndication, which was big, it's a whole other story of why mm-hmm. they did, why they brought back What's Happening Now. But we did 60-something episodes of What's Happening Now. Yeah, we wrote the scripts, you know. There were six of us writing those scripts and stuff.
Hmm.
And we would meet with freelance writers on occasion. Like I say, whenever you'd read a script that was really a good script, you would hire them, like, you know, or you get them to develop usually you would write, like, for instance, Casey and Lee, who we mentioned, they had written a Barney Miller script spec. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you bought. So we read Barney Miller. They were smart. They didn't submit a Jefferson script where we would have mm-hmm. said all this.
Were you involved with Barney Miller?
No.
But no, they, okay.
We had read. We
they
read,
just had done
what
that.
I'm
okay.
saying how it works is if you're on Barney Miller, you don't want to submit a Barney Miller script. You want to submit Jefferson's or somebody else. So it's not your show because if they're mm-hmm. on your show, they're going to be. But we read the Barney Miller script and said these guys write linearly. They tell good jokes and their stories is told. And the two things you look at basically in writing are story and jokes for comedy. Mm-hmm. So in which the first thing I asked students at USC, which I started teaching a while, I spent like 11 years teaching there. The first thing I ask is what's more important, you know, in a sitcom, story or jokes? Mm-hmm. What do you think most people say?
I'd say, well, I think most people say the jokes, right?
Most people, yeah.
But the story is what drives everything, right?
Yeah, well, you know that because you're a writer. That's what you know. Anybody that says story, you know, then I know I got a writer. You know,
okay. Okay.
Kids, how many? We got two guys that say story. The rest yeah. of you raise your hand, and you try to trick them, kind of. Because you say, now remember, it's a comedy.
Yeah, because the jokes are situational. I mean, it's a sitcom, situational comedy.
You can put jokes on. You need that storyline. You need beginning, middle, and end. And you can hang. It's like a clothesline, you know. And you uh-huh. hang the jokes on it all you want, but yeah. you can't. You don't pitch a joke, you know. It's you're telling a story in a situation comedy.
So if you're pitching jokes, you're anyway. A stand-up comic then, right? That's right, it right. might be.
And
your...
that's what happened when Seinfeld and Roseanne and those people came in and start bringing their joke writers in, stand-up guys.
Yeah.
That's when room writing developed, where you, because you can't, a lot of these guys, you can't say like,
yeah, well, that's how that Norman, happened. Oh, okay.
We work for Norman, it'd always be you work up a story, then you go write it. You know, your team or your individual, you go write. And then you come back when you get your script, and then we go over it. Uh-huh. And these room writing stuff where you write every line together, I participate in that. It's just ridiculous because, you know, you've got all – it's trying to – first of all, you'll have guys in there like the shows I mentioned where they're joke writers, and you need joke writers.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to help you out in story. They're not if you send a lot of these writers, and I don't mean to diminish anybody's abilities, but there are certain people who are not writers per se, that if you send them into a room and say, write this, they can't write you a scene.
Mm-hmm.
But they can tell you jokes, and they can, and that's good. There's a time for that, which is punch-up time. You know, once mm-hmm. you got your story laid out, and then you want to punch things up, okay, bring, but you know, ideally, you're going to find somebody who can do both, you know.
Do you still think of jokes, or are you still like a...
Well, I I don't know if they're funny or not. Yeah, sure. I mean, you have to have some
mm-hmm.
comedy. If you're going to write sitcoms, you got to think jokes. In fact, mm-hmm. you know, I mentioned to you Good Times when we went, and mm-hmm. they didn't use any of our jokes, right?
Yeah.
Once I was on staff at the Jeffersons, I made a point of using every joke out of that script
uh-huh.
that they didn't use, and one of them got the biggest laugh we ever had at the time. So,
oh, really?
I just proved to the fact that these are fun. It just
yeah.
when you're rewriting... Somebody else is going to put their joke instead. It's just
yeah, right.
Didn't find your joke funny for whatever reason.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, you got it. You got it. You have to have, if you're a comedy sitcom, you're going to have laughs. And, you know? Mm-hmm.
So then you go on to what's happening now. What like that's still like going back to the 80s. What have you been doing?
Oh, well, you know, we did after Dear John, we worked with Cosby. I went to New York and worked with Cosby. I don't know if I talk about Cosby too much anymore, but you can ask me whatever you want about.
My gosh, we're going to have to do a whole other episode about that now. Right?
He was great. I mean, when we worked
really?
With him,
because people, he said he was great.
He gave my partner a lot of respect. You know, he generally, as a comedian, as a performer, comedians don't like to credit writers. They don't like to speak about writers.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually going on Arsenio, he mentioned my name and Mike Milligan. As,
did he really?
Writing and producing his show, and I thought that was a very sweet thing. He loved New York too. He used to, mm-hmm. you know, be back there freezing and say, you know, Bill, there's a place where the sun's shining now, and there's palm trees. He had a house out here, but he loved walking around and meeting people, like the homeless people. He'd always come to work and have some story about home. You know, he said, people, hey, some guy asked me, give him some money for food. Well, I took him into the restaurant. I paid, uh-huh. you know, instead of giving him the money, I don't know what he's going to do with it, but I give it
so
to him.
So what happened?
Guy.
I mean, that's a whole other episode. I mean, you knew him personally then.
Well, yeah, we work with him. Yeah.
Yeah, and you never got a sense like there's something.
No, not, you know, the women thing is no surprise, let's say that. But
really?
The,
okay.
the drugs is a big surprise.
Okay.
I never would have thought. I mean,
no, not a big surprise because it's him, or just because.
Well,
that's...
because things have been in the, it's not really news, you know. That
okay.
But and that happens in showbiz. I mean, it's not our business, you know. It's mm-hmm. between him and his wife. But
right, it's
and
not.
Camille is a very nice. I actually read her her thesis that she had done for school about television and blacks and television. And in fact, we were talking about one time with Bill, and I said, "Well, here, give it to me. I'll read it." And he's got a wonderful side to him. It's really a shame. I can't.
It's tragic. I think it's, and people just don't, because there's this dichotomy now of like this guy we now know in the news and court and everything, and then the Cosby Show guy. There's this dichotomy. People don't know how to. I think people that even know him, I've heard interviews and that, and people who just loved him because he was talented, like the Music Hall Show or just watching Cosby Show at 8 o'clock on Thursday nights. And you just don't know where to put this in. It's like it doesn't fit. You don't know where to put it.
It's a shame, too, because he kind of sounds like he doesn't get it. You know, he's still kind of denying it. It's the hypocrisy, though. If you talk to comics, you know, it was a comic that kind of outed him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk, he didn't, you know, Richard Pryor and other comics, Bill would kind of, he didn't like the language that they used, and he would criticize them on, you know, and he wanted a good image of black people, you know.
Yeah, right.
And he was very particular about that. And I remember an episode we were doing with, when Malcolm was with a couple college kids, because Malcolm played Malcolm Jamal Warner. And they had two, and they had, the college kids and Malcolm were kind of ad-libbing, going, hey, sup, and just doing kind of black talk. And Cos happened on stage, and he just chilled. What is this? A college education? You know, he was so protective of black dignity.
Yeah.
And so to be doing what he did, such the hypocrisy of it is a little kind of...
It's hard to...
So comics are like, you know, he's telling us what to say, and this guy's doing this. You know, like,
That's... It just breaks your heart. It breaks your heart.
It's very sick, because he went from being America's dad to, America's persona non grata, and it reminds me a lot of what's his name from Penn State, you know.
The coach,
Joe Pa. They got this one day. You're that old, and there's a statue in front
right?
Of
yeah,
state, and the next day they're tearing down the statue. I mean, it's so sad, you know.
Yeah. Oh, it's just incredible.
It's like
it's incredible. So, what are you doing now? What's the latest and greatest?
I'm hoping to get the talk with Joe Wessels. I mean,
okay.
Joe Wessels can get a.
I know I'm hard to get a hold of these days.
Yeah. So, I spent after we kind of I started kind of winding down the TV stuff, which wind you know they always want younger,
you're not really doing
younger
TV
writers
stuff
to get in. Well, now it's all about a younger thing, and I don't even know shows that I would or could. Right, that are on. Mm-hmm. You know, the sensibilities are just different. But I never thought I'd be teaching. But I had a call from USC a while back about teaching down there, and I end up going and figure. Well, you know,
they have an amazing film school, don't they?
Yeah. USC is arguably the best film school in the world. You know, they come from all over the world, go there. But a lot of schools do have. I mean, there's good schools like Chapman, which is a little south of us, and of course NYU. And you know, when I was
you're a professor
when
now.
I was in college. Yeah, one reason
do
I do
they call
that,
you professor.
Know, well, I like them to call me Professor Moriarty. That's one of the perks. You know,
yeah, that's
Professor
cool.
Professor Moriarty was the bad guy in Sherlock Holmes.
I try to be
a good guy. He's the evil nemesis of Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, I didn't.
You know?
Okay, didn't. Sorry,
so
didn't make
I
that
said
connection.
That's. Okay. I always tell the kids, you know, that you call me Professor Moriarty. That's the main reason I come here. You know, certainly not for the money or anything, but they. Kids would call me Professor Moriarty. I said, you know, after the last day of class, I would tell them, now that you've taken a class from me, you can just call me by my first name. But by then, they're so trained that they still today will call me Professor when they see me. But that turned out to be a lot of fun. I wondered what I would, you know, how I'd going down to teach young kids. This is going to be a lot of kids that think they're smarter than you are and know all the stuff and be telling, and it's going to be a real pain in the ass or something.
People told you that ahead of time.
Well, I just anticipated that. I was wrong because I found out that what is like second nature to me now is a revelation to these younger kids. You know, I would teach undergrads and graduate students, and some of them have gone on to do their own shows and stuff now. You know, it's really good. But even, you know, I used to tell them, you don't have to go. It's like you take a history class. You don't have to be a historian or something to, you know, you learn something. So you take a writing class, and I have students go on to be ministers, so they got to write sermons, or lawyers where they have to write stuff.
I've always said with writing, with me, you know, I had to practice good at my writing. With I thought, you know, no matter what else you do in life, if you can write well, you can fool a lot of people. I've thought that for a long time.
You tell me.
You can fool a lot of people by just being somebody could string a sentence together, cover more than a couple of sentences together. That it's a pretty amazing thing. So, and then you're you've got an emergency contact, you said, now your grandpa, the
sweetest, most beautiful emergency contact a guy could have.
Okay.
And her name is Nancy Allen. Yeah, in fact, she's anybody, if you've seen Carrie the movie, she's plays a bad girl in Carrie, John Travolta's girlfriend. She's starring in Dress to Kill, if you remember Dress to Kill. Nancy's been doing a lot of stuff. RoboCop, a lot of people recognize her from RoboCop.
Uh-huh.
I didn't recognize her from any of those movies, but people recognize her all the time. We met actually at a poker. She's the executive director of a cancer support center called WeSpark.
Wow. She's not doing acting anymore?
Basically, she's retired and doing her exec producing that. She's kind of, she likes to, she gets invited to go speak everywhere and stuff like that, but she's she likes doing what she's doing now, so.
That's great. And you got grandkids.
I have grandkids. I have four grandkids.
Some in Ohio, too.
In Columbus, Ohio. My daughter, Colleen, and my son-in-law, Jeff, and there's Lacey and Maya Jane, who are living in Columbus.
I can tell you're a very proud grandpa. You've mentioned your grandkids several times.
Yeah, it's neat to be a grandpa, you know. Yeah. I know I have friends, like a friend is... He had his little grandson, like 4 or 5 years old, and he says, "Well, we go out. Don't call me grandpa." You know, he doesn't want to.
Do you have a name? Because
They call me grandpa, but I've always some little kid calling you grandpa and running grandpa, especially when they're young. You know, they don't run like that to me anymore. But it's just great. It's a joy that I never anticipated. You know, you have kids, right?
So I've got a 4.5 year old.
You'll see that someday.
My sister has four kids. Her oldest is 18. The twins are 14 now. And I remember the first time my nephew, who's 18, he called me uncle, and I'm like, come on, don't call me uncle. I sense it's like the same kind of feeling there that you're saying. I just like, am I an uncle? And then of course, I completely love Uncle Joe and. That is, it's a cool thing. And then now I have this little girl who calls me daddy, and she found out she was pregnant about four days before my 40th birthday. Wow. And lived in downtown over the Rhine, was living the life, living downtown, working downtown. And then the girlfriend at the time says, hey, I'm your what? And we've known each other since we were little kids, so it was. It's been a beautiful thing, and she's the little Emery. She's adorable. She is the light of my life, and she's got two brothers too that are from Nicole's previous marriage, and we're five people. And I started a new job, which was out in the burbs in Green Hills, kind of close to where you're from there in Finneytown.
Right.
And I live in Loveland. So downtown is like this other place. My life completely changed over the matter of like 4 weeks, and it's been amazing. So it's neat. I get that totally.
It's a heck of an experience. Yeah,
I wish
you all the luck.
One last question I think too is just how do you think Cincinnati? What do you think of Cincinnati? I guess maybe I'll ask two questions. What do you think of Cincinnati these days? Do you think about Cincinnati? Do you think about Skyline Chili? Do you think about the Reds? Do you care about that stuff? And do you think any of that like impacted your life and kind of you brought that out here to Hollywood? I guess we can say that. You're a Hollywood guy. You sound like you had a very impressive – you're having still a very impressive career. How does that Cincinnati – how has that affected your life and your career?
I think Cincinnati is a great place to be from. That's what I say. It's
Did you say that in
it's good. In a lot of ways, it's what the sitcom thing is. It's been helpful to be raised in the Midwest, I think, because it's a lot of sitcom writers come from the Midwest.
Okay.
And, shows like The Middle and stuff like that reflect all. But you know how people feel. I think if you grow up in too cosmopolitan of a place, you're not really going to understand the masses and how they think. And I think it's really helped growing up in Ohio. However, when I decided I wanted to make a living as a writer and try to write, I knew I'd have to leave Cincinnati. I knew I'd have to either go to New York or Los Angeles if I wanted to write
for
TV.
Was it hard?
Well, I knew. I thought in New York, I figured I'd freeze and starve, and in L.A., I'd just starve. So I figured that's the better part. We'll go to L.A. But I think you got to make that kind of move. But there's things you learn. For instance, Mark Twain had a great quote about Cincinnati. I don't know if you know Mark Twain's quote.
Sure.
If the world ever ends, you know, I'd hope I'd be in Cincinnati because everything happens there 10 years later.
Right, right.
And there's some positive aspect to that, I guess. Also, since Cincinnati joke, how many Cincinnatians does it take to screw in a light bulb?
No, I don't think I heard this.
It's, one, but do you have to use the word screw?
I've never heard that.
I think that basically, so I might have made that up. I
don't know. Okay. That's a good joke, though. I like that.
I remember taking my parents when they were out, or my dad, to see On Golden Pond. You remember that?
Jane Fonda.
Old people Fonda. And Jane Fonda's parents, yeah. What's her name? Katharine Hepburn. And
Katharine Hepburn, of course. Yeah.
I figured they'd like the movie. I asked my dad afterwards. I said, so what'd you think of the movie? He says, it was okay, but did they have to say suck face? You know, there's a line in there where he says, yeah. That suck face. And right. I don't know. Sometimes, in that Midwest, you just get hung up on little things that seem to kind of ruin your fun. But
well, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. It was great meeting you, talking with you.
And, great talk.
And like that. And
well, good luck with the book.
Book is called Honky in the House.
Honky in the House.
The True Adventures of a TV Writer.
And we're hoping to get that out before.
And by the way, the introduction's be written by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, writing the introduction to the book.
Well, great. Well, congratulations on your career and success, and it's great to talk to you, Jay.
Now that I know you and Chip Chinnery, I know everybody I need to know.
I don't know about all that, but good, all right, Jay, thanks a lot for doing this. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks again to Jay Moriarty for being our very first guest on From Cincinnati. It's great to talk to him out in Los Angeles. He's a great guy and really enjoyed the conversation. Be sure to check out his book. He mentioned a couple times in the podcast, Honky in the House, Writing and Producing the Jeffersons. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other places. It's also available as a Kindle. It does say right now on Amazon that it takes 1 to 2 months to ship, but Jay called me the other day and said that that is actually about to be fixed. There should be copies in stock pretty soon, so you won't have to wait that long. And I do believe the Kindle Kindle version is available right now on Amazon. So you can check that out for sure. Also, check out our website, FromCincinnati.com. Follow us on Twitter at FromCincinnati. We're also on Facebook and Instagram. Be sure to rate and subscribe to the show. And if you like it a lot, leave us a review. That definitely will help people find the show as we're growing here. That would be really appreciated. We'll see you next week for our next episode of From Cincinnati. We've got another very special guest. I think you'll enjoy the chat we have with this person, and you'll find out who that is on Monday. So Merry Christmas to everybody. Happy Hanukkah. If you celebrate Hanukkah, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, everybody, and we'll see you next Monday. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to From Cincinnati. We're online at FromCincinnati.com or at From Cincinnati on Twitter. Search for our page on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and other social media. Send in your guest ideas. We'd love to hear who you want to hear on the show. You can also email us through our website or call 513-549-NEWS or send us a message on social media. Please rate and subscribe to our show in Apple Podcasts. Your ratings and reviews really do help others find the show. If Apple Podcasts isn't your thing, you can find us on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, or we have been told if you hook up the internet to your old Crossley radio, you can find From Cincinnati there. You can even ask your smart speaker to play From Cincinnati. I'm Joanne Lichtenstein, not from Cincinnati, but my sister used to live there. I'm in beautiful Burbank, California, and the voice of From Cincinnati. You can find me and my voiceover services at Joe Voices. From Cincinnati is a production of High Priority Partners, LLC, and is distributed through Loveland Local News. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next Monday and every Monday for a new chat with someone new, because everybody has a story, but not everyone is from Cincinnati.